This is Rafflebix After Hours.
Hello, denizens of the internet. Welcome to Rack Addicts After Hours, the music and technology podcast. The first voice you're hearing this evening, or whatever time of day it may be, is Ben. Today I am joined by Pete.
I don't know what I'm going to say.
Who knows? We'll figure it out later. I'm also joined by Luke.
Hello there.
And today we're going to make some strange noises formed by the human face, and they'll go through the internet waves to your ears, and you are legally obliged to enjoy these. Tough. You're buckled in and you can't escape. But how are you guys? It's great to see you, see actually three people on the podcast. It's been a while since we've had this this three-way going. Luke, it's been a million years.
It has.
Since we've seen you. How have you been keeping, and how is that wondrous beard?
It's very long and very disorderly. I find myself combing it very often these days. But no, I'm well, just enjoying the sunshine today, which was absolutely lovely on the day we're recording this. Yeah, just I've been well, thank you. Yourself?
Pretty good. I'd be interested to see both of you guys, actually. What is your shorts and t-shirt threshold? Because I think we actually hit it today, and I was in a hoodie and jeans, and it didn't go down very well, but I was craving the shorts at that point. About 15 degrees I think we got today.
So I kind of went halfway today. I had a hoodie and shorts combination with trainers.
No, I can get down with that. Yeah, not too bad.
I was t-shirted, but shorts is a bridge too far at the moment. I'd have to be north of 18 degrees, I think.
That's your cutoff point. Actually, weirdly, I think there's two cutoff points, because I'm reluctant to let go of them as we go back into autumn. So I end up creeping below the tens and still clinging to my shorts. But that's a discussion for another season, I think. If we do our usual weekly update, as always, absolutely nothing going on for most of us. But one exciting arrival is not my first child. It's much more exciting than that kind of thing. A Soma Labs Lyra 8 has arrived in Ben's flat.
Ooh,
and it's a something. Luke, have you heard of this one?
I've heard you talk about it before. Is this one of the ones where there's quite a bit of prestige to kind of put it together yourself?
Yes, if you do that. It's not very easy, get a hold of the kit. Pete has managed it. But yeah, it's a bit of a project, because there's no enclosure or anything. But this is the big 8-voice drone machine, and I think it arrived sort of mid last week, and I had a really good sit down with it yesterday. What I was thinking, I don't know if I got into this last episode or if I spoke to you about it at all, Pete, but I was thinking about my usage of the Synthemo Sizor, and maybe not just synthesizers, but general things. The objects that I enjoy, that I've ranted on about for ages, the aesthetic nature of whatever, and go back and listen to some previous Rack Addicts episodes, you'll get the flavour. But what was pretty interesting about this experience is using it was amazing. I'll get back there in a second, but I had quite a good gauge for what the output was in terms of quality. So my partner was in the apartment at the time, and just was disturbed by these horrifying noises that were spewing forth from the living room. And that's pretty much how it goes with the Lyra 8. It's tricky to get what would be conventional music from it, which is part of the fun. So the output to the layperson was displeasing, to put it politely, potentially, or just bloody awful to everybody else. But using the thing was incredibly engaging, and if you're kind of battling with it, and occasionally you hit this a really interesting bassy texture, or maybe some kind of howling bit of feedback, or because of the way the LFO works and it's mostly square waves, you might find a really cool rhythm in there. I don't think any of what I made was usable in any way, and I don't care, because I just had a lot of fun playing with my toys. So it's been brilliant. I might hook it up to an interface and actually just record a jam session, but I don't find I really end up going back through those and chopping out. But I just enjoyed using it, so that's brilliant. I think I'd been trapped in thinking about, ooh, this bit of gear, I could make this with it. Or if I do this, then this exciting outcome might be realized. And forgetting that actually you're going to be using the thing, that should be the fun part. So it's a different angle for me. But
so do you think it would benefit from an effects processor of some description?
Personally, I would like some verb on there. It has the delay, but if you want the delay to be...
Oh, yeah, it's got the... At the top, it's got the effects processor, isn't it?
Yeah, but the delay isn't going to be your typical delay in your musical sense. It's really fun to just play with the feedback and modulating it and getting strange pitched stuff happening. And the distortion is distortion. I don't normally go for much distortion. So maybe a more normal delay.
I think reverb sounds cool. Is it stereo output?
It's just mono.
So just, well, then you don't have to go too over the top with the reverb.
No, I could be very sensible and purchase an affordable guitar pedal or something, but... I do like my Weird and Wonderful, and unfortunately the Weird and Wonderful tends to be expensive. But I will update.
I'll tell you what would be good, and it's not that expensive, would be the little Korg synthy thing that's got effects. Because you can run effects or run external devices through it and use it as an effects processor.
Yes, that is a good idea, and kind of open source and fun. There's some granular stuff going on in there, I think, as well, that you can get from community members. That is a good idea.
I would imagine you'll be bringing the LRA along to the ModCaf if it was so deep that it could actually run at any stage in the flesh.
Definitely. 12 volts, so probably reasonably easy to adapt with various MyVolts, Ripcords, or Leisure batteries.
Oh, you're still talking about outside.
Yeah, I mean, the worry is that our venue might not survive, or we won't be able to afford the venue hire because of other practicalities. But you know, one thing I do want to happen at some point is actually now there is a Soma Labs Lyra 8 trifecta among three of us who run the ModCaf. So at some point there has to be us battling with our instruments, attempting to make something vaguely enjoyable for our audience to listen to. See if we can escape the world of cacophonous drone. But that would be fun. And if it does happen, I'm sure we'll record it and YouTube it, and could be cool. But that's been the only notable thing. Oh, wait, no, I've repotted some plants. But, you know, what about you guys? Who's got some exciting events?
So I've been beavering away and being, up to a point, was being very productive and very pleased with my efforts, mainly recording the Novation Summit, which is
delicious.
What I should be doing, getting down and focusing on a particular instrument and finding its strengths and then utilizing it and actually getting it recorded. Unfortunately, my old nemesis, the technical problem, arisen. So I'd had some success on Saturday just gone, and things are going well, and I'd recorded some bits and pieces, and I was that exuberant about what I'd been doing, I got up relatively early and started again in the studio at about 9:30.
Ooh,
and everything was cracking along, and then I hit the buffers and hit this very niggly technical issue, and the next 5 hours was me reading manuals and softwares. So what it was, the Summit connected with 5-pin DIN MIDI in and out, so I've got a send and return going into Cubase, and I'm able to record a particular sequence using the Summit's own keybed. So I'm recording audio, but I'm also recording the MIDI.
Mm-hmm.
So I generally do that when I'm doing that type of work. And then
I can go back
and tweak the MIDI and sort of quantize it or whatever I have to do. And I can always keep the original recording, but move it to another lane and mute it, and then record a new lane of audio to the nicely quantized MIDI. So that's fine. And then I decide what I need is filter sweeps. So I want to automate it. So I look up all the CC messaging for the Summit, get everything configured as I think it should be between the door and the Summit, and I can actually open the filter on the Summit while I'm recording into that MIDI and actually record the filter sweep as automation, which is all nice. But then it just won't play it back. It plays it back, but it doesn't, either the Summit's not responding to it, or for some reason Cubase isn't sending it's sending the MIDI information, the note information, but I cannot get the Summit to respond to the automation, which I have actually recorded off the Summit. And I've just been round and round in circles, the usual user groups, Googling, reading manuals. It's just a complete buzzkill. You know, you're really the creative juices are really flowing. Everything's going really well, and then you just hit this technical buffers.
So frustrating,
and it just kills the whole thing. You know, if you could just quickly go, yeah, click, 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 or something, oh, that's all right. But hours and hours later, you just wonder, what's the point?
Was there an end to it?
No, it's still, I just cannot get it to work. I can manually record the filter sweep, which is fine. It's accurate, but you want that uber accuracy of a completely sorted bit of automation, which you can draw in and you can have proper kind of...
Have your nice curves and lines.
Yeah,
and everything.
Exactly. Everything's just perfect. Then you know it's absolutely... And then you can adjust it and it gives you that reliability that you can go back and record the audio and you can make other adjustments. Should work. I've got no concept of why it's not working, and I've got no way of telling, because, you know, even if I could monitor the MIDI information, I suppose I could see the addresses coming out. I mean, I don't know, unless you know of a way of actually monitoring the MIDI information coming out of a door. And I suppose there's tools, but I know there is with Mac. Is what's that, MIDI monitor?
MIDI monitor, the Windows equivalent, though I think it hasn't, it's been unsupported for ages, so it's a bit of a blag getting it to work, is MIDI Aux.
Yeah, I think I might have.
But yeah. I don't know that that would let you monitor the MIDI coming from a program. It's more you'd be able to select like a MIDI interface or a controller of some kind.
I mean, the only thing I'm thinking is maybe I try and USB attach it and have more success with the USB.
Maybe.
It's difficult to tell because I don't know what's not working. As I say, I don't know if Cubase is for some reason not sending the automation information out. To the same extent, I don't know if it's the Summit that's not responding to the automated information. Mm. But at some point, there is that particular piece of data is not being translated or received or transmitted. Or received or transmitted.
Nightmare.
So, yes, exactly.
Definitely the USB MIDI would be the only other solution that
Try. But I'll give it a go, but I have this vision of it being exactly the same problem. And I mean... Yeah, other than troubles, if I contact Novation, or not that I'm expecting any great response because it'll be Focusrite, won't it?
Mm.
So if I could speak to them, they might have some answers. But I've gone through the Summit in detail. There's not a lot in the way of configuring MIDI setups. You know, you've just got channel addressing. I mean, it's a bit strange because it's in certain modes, it's behaving like two peaks. So it's actually two synths, and you have to you have to configure the MIDI separately for each one. So they're on different channels and that sort of thing. So that might be something to do with it. I'm just frustrated because the stuff I'm getting out of it is excellent.
Is it? I remember when it sort of first arrived in the shop and we had a bit of a honeymoon period, just loving the sound of the thing. Is it still living up to that?
Ironically, after I got it, so I had this sort of romance with it in respect once we'd heard that sort of buttery filter noise that it was really good at doing, or the buttery filter sweep that it was able to do, and some of the layered patches. And then there was that, I don't know, 6-7 months between the time I ordered it and was able to actually get my hands on it. When I actually got it, I was not that excited. I sort of went, yeah, I've got it now.
Yeah, well, there were some shenanigans getting that one actually through the shop, weren't
there? You know, when you just focus in on it, you go through the libraries and you hear sounds, and certain sounds dictate certain modes of playing, or certain, you know, they inspire you to do certain things. I normally get off the ground quite quickly with that sort of thing. As I say, it's always the technical issue that trips me up, which is most frustrating. Because you talk, and I've spoken to a few colleagues, and they're sort of going, sure, I'm getting the proverbial shrug of the shoulders. It could be anything. Unless you can run diagnostics, which, or do some analysis and actually know what's, you know, if it's in the world of computers, I could measure the data, I can sort of intersect with diagnostic tools and things like that. But there just seems to be nothing really that good for MIDI.
I suppose in the music world, they assume that we're not that level of massive nerd.
Well, you have to be with some of this stuff, really, to get it to work. How else do you get it all to behave itself?
This is why I play drums.
That's how we got our jobs.
Yeah. Anyway, that's been my week. So, again, a bit of an emotional roller coaster. So, I have quite a lot of exuberance about the stuff that I'm actually getting out of the Summit at the moment, and a lot of disappointment in the respect that I can't really nail this automation process, because it's holding me up with, you know, moving on or being, you know, as I say, the creative juices are poured down the drain.
Yeah,
I don't
totally.
Know which way what sort of analogy you want to use, but it really just puts the kibosh on everything. I wish someone would just come along and sort my problems out. I was saying to my colleague, it'd be nice to work. Imagine what it's like for artists when they work in a studio where they've got really skilled technicians, so they don't actually, they can just get on with making the music and not worrying about why things don't work.
You need your own studio gremlin. Yeah. But if you are the studio gremlin, then there's a limit to the time you can
there's
have.
Some really good, really top producers that do everything, and they know the ins and outs, and they've ironed all the creases out the studio themselves. You know, maybe they've got some consultancy or they've got some help, but generally they've worked out all that, and that's what they're good at. So that is half the battle. If you can really get all your technical gremlins sorted out and get the whole thing working as it should be properly with all your instruments and everything integrated with your DAW, it's great to have it all. But if you're not recording this stuff, what are you doing?
Yeah, well, if you got it all right, then you have no excuse to not be in a permanent flow state and churning out albums left, right,
yeah,
and centre.
Yeah, I know, but as I say, it's something that's haunted me for years, that it's always a technical where you get, you know, you can see, you know, something's really exciting, it's really going, and then suddenly it's all over.
You're going to have another stab at it.
Oh, no, I'm not going to give up, but it's just frustrating. It's got to work. There's no reason why it shouldn't work. It doesn't make any sense. It's one of those type of...
Well, I hope you can reclaim that creative spot that you were in.
Yes, thank you.
My total of maybe two times that's happened to me that I've actually made something. I know they're very precious moments. Anyway, do fill us in next week on how that does pan out.
Yes.
Luke, your weekly... Actually, it's been like months since you've been here, so you've got some catching us up-ing to do.
So one thing I have been doing, and with the best of intentions, whenever I buy a new music book, a new set of notation for drums, I always say, I'm going to read this one, I'm going to go through it, I'm going to understand it, and I'm going to play it. And I've had plenty of time, but I am making some inroads into a book that was recommended to me by a friend, Dan, who we all previously worked with. Dan Taylor, if you're listening, miss you, buddy. Hope you're well.
Oh, Dan, what a guy.
What a guy. Anyway, he's an insanely good jazz drummer. Not that he'd ever tell you that, because he's very modest, but he told me to get this book called The Art of Bop Drumming, which is just a manual on how to play that proper... the sort of jazz you see in Whiplash, you know, with the very fast shuffles, proper swing, and, you know, comping on the snare, which is when they play the snare very lightly but seemingly at random to the untrained ear or whatever.
Before you get really into the nitty-gritty, because I am quite interested in this, I had some friends that I was at school with who later went on, after we left school, to form a band called Jessup, Jessup, Jessup. I never found out why it was called Jessup, 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 but they always described their stuff that they were playing. I assume there would be some sort of old standards and stuff, and some of their own bits and pieces. But they called it hard bop. What is hard bop when it's jazz?
So bop is a style of jazz drumming. It's it is just a style that's described in this book, and it's like if you've seen Whiplash, Whiplash is specifically hard bop. That's what they play in that film.
Okay.
So it tends to be big band music, you know, with your sort of your orchestra setup, where the tempos, as far as the drummer are concerned, anyway, is quite fast, and it's got a lot of dynamic variation. But they tend to lean towards the louder style. So, you know, it's your big blazing horn sections, and you know the Buddy Rich style drum solos, all that. Stuff that tends to fall under the umbrella of hard bops. Someone who knows a bit more about hard bop like Dan would be able to give you a better description than that. But I'm just starting the book, so it's been really good. I've gone from not being able to play a swing to being able to play a swing fairly fast, which I'm fairly happy with in just a few weeks. So fingers crossed, and practice willing, that will continue to develop into something where I can actually improvise. But yeah, I'm really enjoying it, and that's what I've been basically doing with the time that I've had available to me outside of work, that and watching a lot of Netflix and Prime Video.
Nice. Are you still on that that cute little cocktail kit that you showed us told us about quite a while ago?
Yeah, exactly. And that, to be honest, I kind of relate to Pete and your woes with the technical issues. I would often be in a mood where I really want to practice or really want to play something or learn something, and I'd go to my old TD9 electric kit, the Roland kit I had, and you know, just be beset by small, usually it was niggles, it was things that you could get around or ignore or just do without, really. But yeah, I decided that that's quite enough of that. Analog is the way forward in terms of practicing drums, because if you can play on the silent cymbals, which is they're sort of their aluminium cymbals that have loads of tiny holes drilled in them, so they're very quiet, but when you hit them, the stick rebounds like a drumstick would on a normal cymbal, so it just feels amazing. And that's kind of, on the one hand, yeah, I can't record anything that I do, but I'm doing it so much more. I'm practicing so much more because I prefer the way it feels. And that's worth it, I think. And it just cuts out that technical issue problem which often crops up. So that's been quite nice.
Nice one. How long have you been working on that Boosh?
For the best part so far of about a lot longer than the amount of pages I've read, I'll put it that way. But it's slow going. It's not a style that I'm used to at all. I came from punk and rock and moved into funk and jazz, you know, well, funk and pop basically, you know, fairly recently in the last few years, and then only just this last year have I decided to have a stab at jazz properly. I've always loved listening to jazz, but playing it has always been a bit beyond my reach. So yeah, a couple of weeks of reading this, I can play a reasonable shuffle now. But well, you know, we'll see. I think I need to read more of it and actually practice nice more one. Of it.
I have also been seized by the romantic idea of grabbing a really solid music book and, you know, ploughing through it and really digesting it, and have absolutely never got even more than 2 pages in. So as the kids say these days, mad props to you, Luke, or however the phrase goes, I don't know. But yeah, that's super cool. So again, please keep us up to date on your learnings.
I will do.
Any brewings in the Words Birth corner of the world?
Well, so obviously the album came out a little while ago, which was very exciting. We finally got that out in the world, which has just been such a massive relief to have it, you know, there on Spotify with the album artwork and all the songs, everything we've been talking about, everything we've not been talking about, just out there, which is lovely. And, you know, the response has been good. We've had a lot more views and like write-ups, and yeah, a lot more engagement than we thought we would, given that everything is locked down. We're obviously selling the limited edition pink vinyl, which is going well as well, so that's going to be really cool when that comes out.
Why didn't anybody tell me about this? Or did I order one and not forget?
I'm pretty sure you've ordered one, but...
Have I? How did one order one when that was the time for things?
It's still going now. It's been extended a little bit. I think there's a fair few copies left. It's on Digger's Factory, Digger's Music Factory or Vinyl Factory.
I'm going to have to search through my emails to see if I have some kind of order confirmation or something, because I absolutely know that if I knew that was a thing, I would have bought one immediately. But I will find out. Remind me once we're finished recording.
I'll send you a link, yeah. There should still be time.
Excellent.
And for anyone that's listening that's interested, we do have a limited edition pink vinyl. Shipping will be around June once it's passed its cutoff and attained the requisite number of orders. Once we've got that, it's just a journey from the store to the factory and then back out in the post, and that's it.
Lovely stuff. Well, looking forward to it, and I do hope that I have already got myself in that queue there. It's generally another quiet week on the news front, as is so often the way, but I have managed to find 3 synthy nuggets for us to chew on for not very long, let's be honest. One is the least newsworthy thing possible, but I think it's quite neat. This is a little 3D printed something that somebody made, just a little cable organization doodad. It's a 3D printed block that you plug 3.5mm cables in and you can stick it to a wall. There we go. That was thrilling, wasn't it? A few seconds of vague news, not at all, but yes, it looks kind of cool. If you want to have a look at that device for your modular needs, it's the Uwin Cable Cube.
How's that spelled?
I think. Uwyn. And then Cable Cube is one word. It's a neat little thing, but it's a little bit, potentially a little bit better than the old drape your cables over something or, you know, just stuff them in a bag. But yeah, that's kind of cool. The actual newsworthy bits, I'll save my favourite one for last. But the first one, there are some new Dreadbox pedals coming out. We do love a bit of Dreadbox here. We have a stereo delay and a reverb. So these are all the kind of, you know, they're teased, so we don't actually have too much information. at the current time, but they follow the same kind of size as the one they had, which is the Comorabi, which is a Corus Flandri type thing. It has a couple of CV inputs and outputs on it. So for the modular head, you've got stereo delay and then stereo reverb. There is also an 8-stage phaser. So basically no information at the current time, but we like Dreadbox. They make cool things and they have pedals coming out soon. If there are interesting demos, we will let you know. Now, the big news. Expressive E have actually ended their silence on the Osmos. We have some news on the Osmos, which we were talking about last episode in relation to the OB6 and Prophet 6 firmware updates. They've given us a production roadmap, as well as introducing a new feature. That new feature is pressure-weighted portamento, which is exactly what you would expect reading that name. Change the portamento time based on the pressure that you're applying to the individual keys. Another thing that sounds miserably tricky to actually perform with, but the demo illustrates it very well, and I can only imagine it warranted a lot of practice for the performer, whose name I don't know, unfortunately, but definitely worth watching it on Expressive E's channel. But most exciting is the production roadmap, which will inevitably be delayed because that's how things happen these days. So, January, so yes, next year, review of the first industrial Osmos series for quality control, apparently. Well, hang on, let me backtrack a little bit. Is this 2021 dates? Aha! No, I tell a lie. Let me roll back. We have a production roadmap, which is partially complete. January is the review of the first industrial prototypes. That's done. February to April, of course, in process at the moment. There's manufacturing preparation, sourcing of electronics, and such. April to June, they project the final industrial Osmos series quality control and operator training. I assume that's going to be training their demo people. And mid-June, mass production and first shipments. So let's use our experience in how things get delayed and how long we've been waiting for the Osmos. Pete, brew up your guess. I'm thinking
September.
Yeah. I'm going to go November just to give us some variety of guesswork here, because November is probably...
I'll put £5 on October then.
£5 on October, okay, I've got November and then we've got September. So we'll pull our Bitcoin or whatever the internet people do these days. I don't understand cryptocurrencies. Anyway, November-ish I think was when we were first talking about it in the first episode of Rack Addicts.
Yeah, November 2019.
There we go. It's a two-year thing and... who knows if we'll see it at the end, but we do keep bringing it up because it is such a cool instrument and a really, really cool expansion on what the piano and the synthesizer is, has, was, can, and might be. I don't know. Lots of worms.
Do we have a price?
Yes, we do. We'll get there at the end. If you have been sleeping under a rock somewhere, the Osmos is this, you know, 5D keyboard or expressive keyboard, and you will want to go to Cuckoo's channel and check out that demo. It has a synthesizer built in. It's the Egan Matrix from the guys at Harkin. Sounds really cool. Now, the price. That's a terrible drum roll because I'm not a drummer. Actually, Luke, we have a drummer with us. Fake drum roll for us, please. Amazing. See, it's it has the seal of approval because Luke is a drummer. Available later this year for $1,799. So, 1,500 quid, maybe more.
Less than I thought it was going to be 2K. Still not cheap.
Still a big chunk. Yeah. And what is it? Is it like 49 keys?
Yep.
Is it 61?
Yeah, 49.
It's small.
Yeah,
you're right, 49. Small thing, but really, really cool instrument. I wonder if they'll do a Roly and make like a big boy one for £5,000 or something horrible.
I don't know. Don't really care as long as, I mean, it's been so long.
Yeah, you. What do you reckon, Pete? Is that something you'd be tempted by?
Well, the one that's coming out in September, October, or November.
Yeah.
Hopefully not December.
prefer it to the Roly solution, and I'm quite interested in the synth that's inside it as well.
What I really, really want to see is there's a YouTuber, originally a classical pianist by training. I will spell out her name because I will probably mispronounce it. It's Nahre Sol. N-A-H-R-E space S-O-L. And I'm quickly, while I'm doing this, I'm going to... So she's got loads of interesting videos up. If you're good with your theory, you'll probably be able to get more out of them than I can. But, and has been encountering synthesizers through lots of collaborations with other YouTubers and brands as her channel's grown. But I really want to see a video with her tackling the Osmos, because that's a really experienced and capable set of hands and ears on, you know, an evolution of the piano. That'll be cool. I hope it happens. Anybody got any other newsy boys? Because that's us done.
Yeah, that's it.
Quickly.
There's nothing left.
Well, you know what that means, listeners. If you haven't tuned in before, we have a captain for our voyage towards the strange pastures of Luke Spacey Bit. Yes, all of those noises were made by my face all at the same time. It's definitely not a backing track, expertly crafted by our own Pete. Luke, take us away.
So, today we're going to be talking about space garbage or space debris, and colleagues, feel free to chime in on this one if you like, if you have any questions or any suggestions.
I probably will. I highly doubt I have constructive thoughts. I will be the layman here, because I know nothing.
That is fine. I am somewhat lay. It is all good. Therefore, we shall begin. So today, as in on early Monday morning, the day we are recording, a Soyuz rocket was launched from Baikonur in Kazakhstan, containing 38 new satellites, one of which was a demonstration of exciting new tech for the removal and deorbiting of space debris. It's been produced by Astroscale, which is a small company in South Korea. I think they're actually headquartered in Tokyo. Nevertheless, they are... Their mission sort of statement is to make space and space development more sustainable in the future. And so they have developed this package called the End of Life Services by Astroscale, or ELSA for short. So ELSA is this new satellite they're putting up to handle space debris. It's just a test bed at this stage. So the actual official name is ELSA-D, which is short for demonstration. But the idea is that this technology, once they've tested it, can work, could be sent up in future and applied to removing and actually deorbiting errant and useless satellites that are just cluttering up low Earth orbit.
Sounds like a good idea to me. All I've got in my head at the moment is just, well, you said it is from Russia, so obviously it looks like Sputnik, but it's got a robot arm with a giant horseshoe-shaped magnet on the side, and they're sort of waving it around, collecting paper clips. That's what's in my head.
That might be required one day. This one's kind of designed to... It's very small and very square. It's a two-part vehicle. One part is called the servicer and the other part is called the client. So again, bear in mind this is just a simulation. Well, no, it's really going up there, but it's a demonstration at the moment. It's not actually going to deorbit any errant debris. But the servicer unit is this big square gold solar paneled thing. Looks like a satellite. And the client is a tiny little CubeSat thing, a little silver counterponent. Looks about the size of a big dinner plate, I think, or a laptop. Once they've left the Soyuz vehicle, they'll push off into orbit somewhere, and then they'll separate and begin a game of orbital cat and mouse, or hide and seek, if you will. The client unit will shoot off somewhere, and then the servicer will be sent to chase after it, hunt it down, and grab it, essentially simulating a successful capture.
Oh, cool.
So they'll do this a few times to demonstrate that the technology works, to actually iron out any creases that might appear in the process. One of the things they're going to do is they're going to have the client spin uncontrollably to kind of simulate better something a bit more like what an inactive satellite might actually be like, to try and capture, to prove that ELSA, the servicer part of ELSA, can actually cope with that sort of debris. Because more often than not, once a satellite runs out of power, its reaction wheels fail, it probably hasn't got any RCS thrusters, or it hasn't got any fuel or power of any sort, no positioning system, so it's probably just tumbling, which is quite hard to deal with. So yeah, they're going to hopefully prove that ELSA can deal with that. And then once that's done, once they've docked together for the last time, conducted their last rendezvous test, the two will then deorbit and burn up in the atmosphere, concluding the experiment.
Is that the plan for the assuming the sort of commercial functional unit, assuming it all goes ahead, is that the idea? Collect a bunch of the junk and then just burn it up in the atmosphere rather than try and bring it back or do anything else with it?
For this specific technology, for this shape and size, they are looking at grabbing satellites that will be successfully burnt up through deorbiting. They won't be getting anything that can come down and actually land. It wouldn't make it through unshielded for one thing, but for another thing, it's just going to basically grab things that we don't particularly want to save. So they'll come through the atmosphere and burn up in the plasma as they re-enter. I should say.
Nice one.
My only thoughts about this was they were saying they're going to use strong magnets to facilitate this. And I was thinking, surely lots of satellites are made of aluminium and non-ferrous materials that magnets would have no effect on.
Yes. So I'll be interested to see how they changed that. I think this particular unit is... So obviously this particular unit has a magnetic docking receiver on the actual client unit, the smaller satellite, for the purpose of the test. But that's an interesting thing. I think, as far as I remember, there are also some sort of appendage as well, but I don't think it's going to be a claw of any sort. So, yeah, I don't know how useful this will be for most aluminium stuff. I think they might be going after stuff that perhaps does contain some magnetic components, because there will be some... plenty, I'm sure, up there. But yeah, you're right.
I suppose strong enough magnet, as long as there's something ferrous on there, you might be able to get somewhere with it.
There's quite a few different techniques various organizations have been developing over the last few years. I saw one where there's a kind of harpoon system where they would harpoon satellites.
It's whaling in space.
I think there's other ones where they'll have a sort of net type thing. Because, I mean, it's not just the sort of large, chunky satellites that create the problem. It's also the flakes of paint, isn't it? You know, a flake of paint travelling at 17,000 miles an hour isn't the sort of thing you want hitting your visor.
Exactly. Very dangerous, yeah. The ISS and other satellites, you know, semi-frequently readjust their orbits all the time to avoid micrometeorite strikes from paint chips, bits of insulation that's accelerated to, you know, that sort of speed. It's a lot more hazardous, even if it's quite soft and small. If it's traveling at that speed and then hits something that's relatively still compared to it, that's a bad time. So yeah, that's the idea, is to put as many different ideas up there to try and deal with space debris before we get something approaching Kessler syndrome, which would be awful. The idea that you could get a cascade where debris knocks into other debris, into other debris, and renders, you know, orbit inescapable because there's a shield of crap, as it were, around the Earth, which would be, you know, not ideal.
So we've not only managed to pollute the whole Earth, we've managed to start polluting near space.
Yes.
It's going well. Human race doing us proud once more.
Yeah. Well, yeah, at least people like Astroscale, and I think the net one was Oxford Space Systems a couple of years ago, I think, was it, or something like that. Yeah, at least companies like that are looking into these kind of technologies that will clear up space. We might, you know, there are lots of shows. I watched a South Korean sci-fi recently on Netflix called Space Sweepers, in which they predict a future where most of life is conducted in orbit, basically, and there's a great deal of stations up there. It's quite well done. The special effects are fabulous. It's mostly CG, obviously, but yeah, the main characters, their job is they go around picking up stuff, space garbage truck, basically. The universe is quite interesting in Space Sweepers because they're actually quite competitive. They trade their, it's very dystopian hyper-capitalism. They trade their scrap for money, and it's all very dark. But perhaps something more realistic might be an actual large-scale deployment of space debris collection services. Who knows?
I think it's imperative if we're going to push ahead. It's obviously considered to be a major problem. And you can imagine if you're operating several multi-billion dollar satellites, the last thing you want them to be is written off by some spurious bit of debris whipping past and cut them in half.
As humans become more ubiquitous in space, say you have a passenger liner going up for an orbital flight coming back down the other side of the world, you don't want that getting hit by paint on the way down and exploding and killing all the passengers. So yeah, it's definitely something that needs to be looked at. They do track a lot of the larger stuff. Anything that's basically larger than like a human arm or whatever is tracked quite well and quite persistently by installations like Arecibo that are now gone, unfortunately, but other stations like it. But there's a great deal more that's unaccounted for, which is obviously quite scary.
Yes.
But, you know, positive thoughts. Yes. ELSA is a step in the right direction, at least.
Astrally inclined listeners, yes, maybe thinking about the warp drive that isn't in the room at the moment. Especially as I know nothing about these kind of things, I think we will benefit from a really nice unpacking so that my tiny brain can comprehend such things. So Luke is going to be working on that one for us next week. Best subtitle for any episode ever. Rec Addicts After Hours, episode 66, Warp Drive Special. Do tune in next week on whichever podcasting service you so desire.
Oh, Ben, that was very much meant to be between us. I've got to understand a lot of physics to do that one.
Now I've called you out on it, you have no excuse.
I will have to read
you
the physics.
You can't escape. Oh, you'll have to do a physics. Yes. While Luke, of course, does a physics for us, that means we're coming into the tail end of our podcast. And at this point, unless you have any more spacey things for us.
Not today, no. I've my plate is now very much full with physics.
Excellent. Well, you get studying, go get that degree in a week, and then I'm sure we'll be fine. But the tail end of our podcast, if you're new here, always concludes with the miscellaneous multimedia recommendation. And Pete, you say you've got quite a juicy one. Do you want to save that to round us off, do you reckon?
Yes, I don't mind.
Excellent. I have mine ready to go. It's quite a light one if you're thinking, if you're feeling, cranially challenged. You want to go for a bit of light-hearted comedy. One of my favourite Bitterfry and Laurie sort of micro-series in their show, A Bitterfry and Laurie, would be, I think it's just called Control, I guess. There's a few of them where they're intentionally over-underacting, or actoring, as Tomska put it. But, you know, it's really terrible acting, but that makes it really funny. There's kind of MI6 agents going, "Control? Are you a secret Russian spy?" "No, I'm not a secret Russian spy. Cross my heart and hope to die." That kind of thing. Think of that intentional terrible acting and apply it to two young Australian dudes. This is Fairbairn Films on YouTube. And there's something incredibly reassuring about intentionally terrible acting that just makes it so much better. We have highlights for me as such things as getting pulled over by the police, phone service in Australia, and the world's easiest scam call. Those are some of my favourite Fairbairn's Films sketches. All pretty short, pretty digestible, very Australian, and get quite shouty, which, if that's your kind of sense of humour, it'll be right up your street. Fairbairn Films for some bite-sized Australian comedy. Good stuff. Luke, do you want to take it away?
Of course. Just quickly, though, Fairbairns, is that like Australian for fair enough, or like...
No, I think it's a surname, like Fairbairn.
Ignore me, Fairbairn. Then. So my recommendation is another light-hearted one. You might have heard of Corridor Digital over the years, if you were ever into YouTube back in the day, Freddie Wong and people like that. This is a channel called Corridor Crew, where it's a bit more informal. The people behind Corridor Digital spend some time making videos showing things that either they're interested in, how they did their stuff, or critiquing other studios and other works, usually mainstream stuff, because obviously they're a YouTube content creation arm. I think they do some professional work as well, but their home was YouTube, if you like. And one of the series I quite enjoy is the VFX Artist React playlist, which is they're now into the 30s or 40s. Each video is about 10 to 13 minutes long, which is just a good chunk of watching, and they're pretty funny. It's also weirdly informative. I now find myself watching films with a very critical eye for CGI, and I learned a lot about how VFX is done, not just today but back then, because obviously it's a craft that has evolved very quickly with the advancement of computing power, with, you know, the technologies and AI that we have at our disposal now. But most of all, it's quite funny and interesting. They'll pick a range of works that some are terrible, some are so terrible they're basically memes, or they'll take stuff that's stellar and they'll break it down and show you that actually everything you thought was real completely isn't. And some of it's quite startling, where you go, wow, I can't believe they managed to make that look that convincing. And some of it is quite funny, where they'll show you something terribly basic and they'll explain what you could do to make it better. It's generally quite lighthearted, and I really enjoy it. That's VFX Artist React on Corridor Crew.
I'm a big fan of the Bollywood episodes, because some of those action scenes are just completely stupid but really fun.
Yeah, they quite like the Bollywood stuff. It's because they're so over the top, but it's actually quite well done. And so yeah, it's still definitely worth a watch, all of that stuff.
Yeah, what's really great as well, apart from when they get some of the actual artists in, and obviously we can feed off their experience, but they really know their stuff as well, because they do things where they'll take a certain scene, and a few of them they'll go, "We took this film and made it R-rated," you know, yeah. And you put loads of extra sort of blood and guts and things, or they redid sort of the facial animation on that one Mummy film with, not Vin Diesel.
No, the Scorpion King with The Rock. Is that the one you're thinking
of? Yeah, The Rock,
of?
Yeah. And it's just the weirdest thing, and then in the original just kind of looks so unnatural.
Yeah.
And they explain why, and then they go and fix it, so you know. They know their stuffs, them.
I quite enjoyed the one where they took on a real giant. They had a go at the Mandalorian and said, we can do Luke Skywalker's face better.
Ooh, I haven't seen that one yet. That's a big claim.
And actually, that's a big old spoiler, so we might have to edit that out.
Whoops.
But that's a great video. Watch that.
Nice one. Pete, what do you got for us there?
This one appeared in my YouTube stream, and I've been binge-watching it. It just popped up literally last week. And it is the Wyoming PBS, as in Public Broadcast Service.
Oh, yeah.
A lot of it's very parochial. The description is public media, public television, news, current affairs, art, history, culture, and education. So I don't know if you can sort of form the analogy. It's a bit like the BBC sort of thing, because I get the impression it's the PBS networks are not commercial. I could be wrong with that. Obviously, we don't get PBS over here in any other form than virtualized like this in the cloud. So this is the PBS channel on YouTube for Wyoming, and as I say, most of it is not of any particular interest. It's local politics, bits and pieces about the election as it relates to the state of Wyoming, other various things, but there's quite a few really good informative historical episodes, if you want to call them, and they're generally about an hour and a half long. And I, as I say, I've been binge watching them literally all week. I mean, I didn't really know much about Wyoming.
I definitely couldn't put Wyoming on a map, so nothing here.
Yeah, I don't know much about the Midwestern states, but it's quite interesting how key Wyoming was to the, certainly in the movement west. So I've learnt in detail about many of the wagon trains that were crossing in the sort of mid-1800s onwards, and the Indian Wars. I mean, it's a land of contrast. I mean, it's got these massive flat plains, it's got three mountain ranges, it's got deserts, it's got everything. And it's very square. I don't know if you look at a map of the US with all the states painted out, it's one of the really square ones in the middle. Literally, it's a square. I've never really thought about it, but I wouldn't mind going there. I mean, one of the things that is key, up in the top left-hand corner, they've got Yellowstone. So I would imagine most people have heard about Yellowstone and the Tetons,
Georgia,
and that. But there's so much else there as well. It's a phenomenally large state, like many of the states in the US. It's one of those I've got a kind of yearning to drive across it. One of the last documentaries I watched was about the Lincoln Highway, which was the first road from east to west, or west to east. But this is actually a road from New York to San Francisco, which you can mostly follow.
One thing that I've kind of discovered through the bike packing thing, which is huge in America, is just covered in this massive network of gravel roads, which is probably from, you know, the kind of the really early development that you're speaking of in that particular episode. If they're going to follow those old lines, they build next to it, and those gravel roads do stay. So there's actually races that, you know, go all the way across the country just on little dirt paths that have been there since modern America. It's pretty cool.
Yeah, but it's just definitely somewhere I'd like to visit now. I mean, I have been to the US, I've worked in the US a few times, but generally it's always on the coast, isn't it? I used to work in Chicago and also in Silicon Valley for a time, but you don't often get the opportunity to go into the central parts. There's never really a need.
Yeah, sounds really good. I might give that one a look, actually, because after chugging through a bunch of Ghost Town Living, there's a certain feeling that you get from that kind of environment. You know, the sort of the saloons and that time period. Probably if you play a bunch of Red Dead Redemption, not that I've actually played it, but I imagine that would be quite a good extension, jumping on some of those documentaries. Right, so to round off that Rack Addicts After Hours, episode 65, we've got Fair Bend Films, Corridor Crew, and was it PBS Wyoming, Pete?
Oh, Wyoming PBS.
Wyoming PBS, the other way around. As always, our dear listeners, thank you very much for listening. And don't forget, it will be the Warp Drive episode next week. No pressure at all, Luke. But thank you for listening. Tune in next week, and we'll catch you then. Farewell! We'll be right back.